The public gets thrown out of a public chamber. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, drama as the Jacksonville City Council closes its public chambers over the objections of voters. Join us. Call us up now. It's 549-2937. Then later, support is growing even stronger for full cannabis legalization here in Florida. We'll tell you about that too. All of that and more ahead, but first this hour, an extraordinary scene last night at a meeting of the Jacksonville City Council. The council threw the public out of the chamber as members prepared to vote on a controversial issue involving school funding. They even removed Senator Audrey Gibson. Times Union reporter David Bauerlein was there, and he joins us now with more. David, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for turning around and coming in early this morning after last night. And we're already getting your calls about this. Give us a call at 549-2937. Okay, set the scene for us. What led to this dramatic turn of events?
Well, it was, as you said, extraordinary. Essentially, the city council was debating whether or not to put a referendum on the ballot that's been sought by the school board for several months to let voters decide whether they want a half-cent sales tax for schools. The council majority of council members voted ultimately to withdraw that legislation, which means it's not going on the ballot. And as they were starting to debate that, there was a lot of reaction from the people in the crowd. It was an overwhelmingly supportive crowd for the referendum. A lot of them wearing red shirts to show solidarity. Rory Diamond, the city council member who put forward the motion to withdraw, at one point said that the referendum would fail in its current plan. That triggered some reaction from the crowd because they are convinced it will pass and have seen public opinion polls that show strong support for it. So that was the first reaction. And then Councilmember Leanna Cumber followed up agreeing with Rory Diamond and also saying she started to criticize the school board and the superintendent, and that created another reaction from the crowd. The council president, Scott Wilson, had earlier warned the crowd against having any kind of making any noise, basically. And at that point, then, he ordered the entire room emptied. Which, as you say, extraordinary. I've been a newspaper reporter for 30 years. I've never been in a city council meeting in any city I've worked
at. You've been to a lot of, these meetings.
Yeah. Where the whole room was ordered empty. I've seen cases where someone who was being disruptive was told to leave. But to have the entire room cleared of the public, never seen that happen before.
Extraordinary. They removed Senator Audrey Gibson. They kicked out all of the media. Channel 4's Jim Pigott. Thankfully, took a stand and said, you'll have to arrest me if you intend on removing me from this chamber. So kudos to him for standing up for democracy.
Exactly.
Are they within the law? Is the council within the law to clear the chamber in this manner?
The short answer is, I don't know, Melissa. I'm not sure. And that's something we're trying to look at in terms of what the authority is. I mean, obviously, the city council president has a great deal of power in order to decide how the meeting is run. And if he feels like there's a disruptions or interfering with the meeting, then he has authority to take some action. So whether that means that everybody's got to leave or whether you just got to pick out the people who are causing the quote problems, I don't know what his authority is. But obviously, he gave the order. The sergeant in arms carried it out, and everybody was told to leave.
And to add a little clarification, people could still watch a video feed of the proceedings, so there was still some access. But that said, the optics of this are terrible. I think most might agree. For the representatives of the public to throw the public out of a meeting because it got raucous.
Right. And the deeper political irony in this is that they were debating whether or not to give the public an opportunity to vote on a sales tax referendum, and in the course of that debate, ordered the public out of the room. So it does lend to this idea that all of this is being done kind of inside baseball, and the public, that some council members have said repeatedly, just wants to be able to vote on this. was not able to even be in the room at the same time that city council debated right. whether to do that or not.
And to be clear, the Duval mm-hmm. County School Board, which has retained outside counsel, has been simply asking the Jacksonville City Council to put this matter before the voters. They want to go on the ballot this year. That is now not going to happen. Some city council members have said that they'd be willing to put this before the voters if there was a certain pool of money set aside for charter schools in Duval County. That's been the controversy. Those that were in the crowd last night were angry because they feel that the council is improperly stepping into a matter that is the purview of the Duval County School Board, that their only role is to put the matter on the ballot so the voters can decide. That's where the controversy comes from, correct?
Exactly. Exactly. It's a question of to what extent is the school board in charge of deciding how to fund the schools? To what extent is city council, in essence, over the school board and able to act as sort of a super school board, at least in this matter of the half-cent sales tax referendum?
Let's go to your calls now. We're getting calls from folks that were in the room last night and are just hearing about this as the Jacksonville City Council threw the public out of chambers last night before voting to withdraw a measure having to do with a half-cent sales tax referendum for local schools. Rose is on the line. Hi, Rose. How are you? Hello, Rose. Are you there? Okay, Rose, give us a call back. Let's go to Tom on the west side. Tom, good morning.
Good morning to you all, too. Yeah, it was absolutely chaotic. It took well over 15 minutes before they even had the audio loud enough to be heard in the overflow rooms. And, you know, you have to take into account the fact that it was a sea of red there between the JEA workers and the teachers all wearing their red. So blaming the school board was not going to be a positive step for the city council to take there and was not going to be well received. The worst part of the chaos, though, there were two people waiting to speak that should have been heard. And unfortunately, in the chaos, they never got a chance to speak because they had to leave. And that's Sonny Gettinger and Chris Garari, who writes quite frequently about education.
Okay, Tom, thanks for that. You know, to give a fair look at the proceedings last night, the council did have the difficult task of trying to manage this very contentious discussion. And as the caller pointed out, there were also people in the crowd who are upset at the push to privatize JEA. That said, critics of both this mayoral administration and the current city council see all of these controversies as part of an overall problem for the city of Jacksonville, David, don't they? That there's been a push toward privatizing the public utility, critics say, siphoning money away from public schools. And so if you're unhappy with what you're seeing coming out of Jacksonville City Hall, you see all of this is tied up together.
I think that's right. I saw one tweet yesterday, and it was kind of a graphic depiction of two people, hands clasped, and one of the hands had JEA as ours over it. The other one had sales tax advocates over it. There's becoming this sort of, I don't know if it's an actual coalition or just overlapping interests, but I think there is a sense among the public that, hey, we want to vote on this half-cent sales tax for schools. Can you put it on the ballot? At the same time, the city is moving forward with the potential sale of JEA, which then would go to a referendum. So it's a little bit of a mixed message, right, in terms of mm-hmm. when is the public going to get to weigh in on these matters and when are they going to be prevented from doing so?
Kay is in Nocatee. Hello, Kay. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I believe that you have discussed what the legalities were. I don't know if this falls under Florida Sunshine Laws, so please excuse my ignorance and knowing all the particulars, but I do think that the public should demand, and so should the news media, that this be investigated. And the other final comment is, people talk about problems, they go on, but when it comes time to vote, A, it's statistically shown that the majority of people don't vote, but if they're unhappy with who represents them and how they manage our government, and the school board and all those other things. Get to the polls and vote logistically how you feel government should be run. So
thank you, Kay.
Nice day.
Right. And certainly there are many supporters of the city council representatives on both of these issues. That said, this is a reminder, if we ever needed one, that elections have consequences. If you don't turn out and vote, you might not be happy with the result of what representatives do. In order to weigh in, you need to get out and vote.
Oh, that's true. I think there were some council members who voted last night to withdraw the legislation. If the elections had gone the other way, there would have been council members in those seats who would have authorized moving forward with the half-cent sales tax. I'm not saying which is better, which is worse. I'm just saying that you're absolutely right. It does matter in terms of those elections, in terms of who fills those seats.
Linda is in Deerwood. Hello, Linda. Go ahead.
Hello. I don't think that it's part of our Constitution because they were probably too smart, but we really need recall legislation in our state to be available because I know I read an article in the Jacksonville paper yesterday that said one of the reasons they didn't want it was because they wouldn't have enough turnout. Most of these people got elected with 14% turnout. I think it's a travesty, and I know it's hard for the news media here because you guys are bombarded with so much, but I'm going to float this idea outside of Jacksonville. Corruption in a mid-sized town, how it happens when you have just movement without the people involved. You just get shoved down your throat what they're going to do for you, and they tell us, well, you don't need to vote on this legislation by fiat. It's just maddening. Thank you, guys, for just keeping this in front of people. Thank you,
Linda. There have been some calls by some stakeholders around town for an investigation into a lot of doings at City Hall. There has been some scattered talk of recall. As she pointed out, getting a recall petition going against anyone who's in public office is a pretty high bar.
It is. I would not say that's a likely scenario that's going to pan out. There's probably other efforts. If people really want to move things at City Hall, there's probably more effective ways to do it than having a recall petition.
Tiffany on the north side. Hey, Tiffany, good morning.
Hi, Melissa, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a parent that was there last night that had the privilege of having on one of those red shirts that let the voters decide, by the way, was designed by Duval County Public School parents. I do want to say that as this conversation continues to unfold, one of the topics that continues even on last night, the per student funding model that so many of our council members are for. And one of the key things that we're missing here that is going to throw us back into the 1950s and 60s, that with a per student model, which many of them are for, what that does is, yes, it allocates money across the board to all students. But what it also does is give millions of dollars to charter schools and take billions of dollars that we desperately need to repair for the 911 maintenance. Last night was horrible from a parent's perspective to be thrown out of a room when we are there standing together to speak on behalf of our children and our future children. And I will also say, as this unfolds, City Council needs to remember that there are Duval County students in 10th grade, 9th grade, that will be voters soon, and they behind are going to be voted out.
Tiffany, thanks for the call. Lots of calls on this. Let's get to a few more. Larry on the west side. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. How you doing, Melissa?
Good. Go ahead.
Okay. In fact, I think we witnessed several mayors that ran on the polls over the past, 20 years?
Yeah, speaking right into your phone, Larry. Having trouble hearing you.
Okay, can you hear me better?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I think it was in several mayors that ran on the polls. It seems to me that we're in a tyrannical government down there. And I just heard about what happened last night. And, Jacksonville voters, citizens, just need to stand up, and start dealing with these people in terms of, organizing, voting, and stuff like that. It's ridiculous. They just run ripshod over our city.
Thank you, Larry. Lots of tweets echoing that sentiment coming into the show. Let me get to just a few of them. Here's one from Dan. This is BS, he says, of the highest order, and the Jacksonville City Council should be embarrassed. You aren't dealing with international sanctions or terrorism. You are dealing with families and their children's educations. Do your job, he says. Here's one from Samantha. The city council threw the public out of chambers, the same public who put them in their seats. He says, extraordinary. Michael tweets the show. The same city council that says that the Duval County School Board should hold the public info and comment meetings before the city council will approve, despite the fact that the school board held 20 or more such meetings, is the council that removed the public from not just the discussion, but also the room. Sierra tweets the show. This one isn't going to blow over quickly or quietly. People are sick of the shut up and deal with it attitude from City Hall. This frustration we're getting, David, from folks out there that they feel that the city council is not representing the views of the majority of their constituents. Here's a tweet, and I'm not, let me precursor this by saying I have no idea if this is valid. I'll check it out. Someone just tweeted, we're hearing from the Duval County School Board meeting that the governor may remove the school board for violating the city charter. I have no way. I don't know about that. We'll have to look into that for whoever tweeted us that one. Here's one from Matt. Winning Sweet 400 and a couple of council seats uncontested has led the ruling class to believe that disagreement is an inconvenience. They won't fear the voters until they are given a reason to. Strong feelings out there.
So I agree, it's not going to blow over, absolutely. And it is kind of ironic that one of the things that the city council said over and over again to the school board is you need to go out and have more community meetings. They had 20 meetings, you do more of them, and then basically you have what it's essentially was a large community meeting yesterday where the public was told to leave the room. Now, I have no idea what's going on with this deal on the governor and the school board. I know that the school board has disliked and disagreed from the beginning with this interpretation of state law, which is unique to Jacksonville, that basically has given the city council the authority to reject outright the referendum. No other county in the state has taken that position. And that seems to be the next evolution, which would be go to court.
And the school board has retained some heavyweight local attorneys. People are waiting their next move. Will they do that?
Absolutely. And they can just represent kids. You know, they don't have to represent the school board. They can have a family out there that feels like they want to vote on the sales tax and they're in a school that's that needs the help. And they could be the plaintiffs in the lawsuit.
Charlotte in Springfield. Hi, Charlotte. You're on the air.
Hey, 2 points. One, I thought that this new council president had, in fact, also dismissed the public before. And then I also wanted to circle back to the caller Kay, because I'm really interested in how Sunshine Law does affect a closed door meeting with council members that pertain to a public vote.
Thank you. Yes. And we do need to, this just happened, so we're rushing to get more background and context for people, David. What the Sunshine Law specifies with regard to whether Council President Scott Wilson was within his rights to toss the public out, because as we mentioned, they could still view the proceedings on a video feed.
Right. Let me go back. I'm not aware of Council President Scott Wilson throwing the public out of any other meetings. It may have happened. I'm not aware of it. In terms of the Sunshine Law, yeah, you're right. I mean, basically they can say, well, look, everybody could go and watch this on TV in these overflow chambers, these rooms on the first floor of City Hall, and maybe that's the argument that it was still in the sunshine. Now, I have my own questions about why some people were allowed in and others weren't. I'm certainly an advocate for the press being right there every step of the way. I don't know that we have any particular privilege that the public has above and beyond what the public would have to be right there in the room itself listening to the meeting.
Okay. Let's take one more call. It's Andy calling from downtown. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
You're right. Elections do have consequences, and that may mean that the person you want to take office won't take an office. That's number one. So everybody gets upset when their candidate or their favorite individual doesn't get elected to office because, what did the previous caller say, voter turnout was low? Well, then it is what it is. That's number one. Number two, council president has the right to throw out anybody who's disrupting the meeting. And the buzzword since this president's taken office is snowflake. I'm sorry that all these snowflakes decided to attend a city council meeting and gasped and said what they needed to say, and it got them booted from council chambers. Number three, nobody has asked the question of any school board member that I've heard on your show or read in this paper or seen on any news broadcast about why the school board does not receive any money from the state or the federal government for capital funds and capital improvement projects.
Andy, we have talked about that on the show, and both the superintendent, yes, we have, and the superintendent and the school board chairwoman have explained that the sales tax of half cent is the only legal mechanism they have in this city to raise revenue for school repair and construction.
And is somebody in the media, are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. We have researched that. But no, we're not. But thank you, Andy, for the call. Okay. So what about his argument that he felt that the people in the room were snowflakes?
Well, I mean, basically, there were people who were having vocal reactions. That was not everybody in that room. And there was collective punishment. Everybody in the room was told to leave.
Okay. David Bauerlein, as always, incredible work from you at the Florida Times Union. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, here we go, guys. Welcome back. Lots going on with cannabis here in Florida this week. We have an update from two experts, Sally Peebles, partner at Vicente Cederberg and a member of the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee, and Shelton Hall, columnist who covers cannabis at Folio Weekly. Hey, guys. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Good morning.
Sally, let's start with you. An important court ruling that has to do with medical cannabis in Florida. What's new?
So back in July, the first DCA issued an opinion stating that the limit on licenses at the state level and required vertical integration were unconstitutional. And then that opinion was issued by a panel of only three judges. The Department of Health then requested a rehearing on banc, meaning they asked for the entire panel to rehear it and reconsider those issues, saying they were a matter of great public importance. Yesterday, the first DCA dug their heels in and actually denied that request for rehearing. Why everyone is pretty... why this is getting a lot of talk is because in the opinion itself, the concurring drafter said the statute so clearly conflicts with the Constitution, en banc review is unwarranted and would serve only to further delay the inevitable, which is to allow for the Supreme Court to weigh in and definitively pass upon the matter. And that is why this is getting a lot of talk, because he's basically kind of wink, wink, nod, nod to the Supreme Court. You know, this is going to get appealed to you, and when it does, you should pass. And he had an opportunity in this opinion yesterday to lay out why he believes that is. It was kind of a second bite of the apple for them to lay out their opinion on why they believe the vertical integration is unconstitutional.
So what's the real world impact of this decision?
So right now, things would stay the same. The Department of Health has the decision whether or not they're going to now appeal to the Supreme Court. This was pretty expected that they would not allow an en banc rehearing. It's the the important part is that they're kind of telling the Supreme Court that they should pass as well. He even says in his opinion, you know, that this isn't groundbreaking. Things are going to stay the same. He said no floodgates will open to threaten ruination on society. What will probably happen right now is they'll appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court may or may not pass, but in the meantime, things will stay the same. If the Supreme Court does pass, then that original first DCA opinion will stand, and the Department of Health and the legislator will have to take a hard look at the statute and redraft it so it is not deemed unconstitutional by removing the required vertical integration.
But for the moment, the way medical marijuana is distributed to the public is going to stand pat.
Absolutely. Things will stay the same. The medical marijuana treatment centers, the 22 that we have in the state right now, will continue to operate as is.
Okay. And as we watch for any changes on that, Shelton Hall, a new poll was also published this week showing that overwhelmingly Floridians support legalizing marijuana for recreational use. 2/3 of likely Florida voters polled favor full legalization. Does that mean we might see this make it onto the 2020 ballot? Will Florida voters get a chance to vote on legalization next year?
Probably not, but we can be hopeful. And also, there was recently a poll from the Public Opinion Research Lab at UNF that had a 84% approval for legalizing marijuana. They were talking about the Garrett Dennis bill, which was just knocked down. And of course, his soul brother number one, my main man, David Bauerlein, just told us.
I've never heard him described as soul brother number one, but I think that might stick.
It has to be that way. It must be. But as we just were talking about, the fact that the public may be overwhelmingly in favor of something, you would think 84% support would be enough to at least get the thing up to a vote, but not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
There are other factors at play. The governor, you know, his personal views on the subject are still a bit unclear, but what he's done his whole term is every move he's made has been in favor of transparency and openness, getting more voices into the process and expanding the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So if it was up to him, things would go through, but we have to see what happens with cities.
Getting something on the ballot is you have to have a lot of signatures, yes. Sally, to get the petition set up properly so that a constitutional amendment can even be placed before the voters.
Yeah, absolutely. And right now there are three being considered taken a look at by the voters. They haven't made, none of them have made it to the ballot yet. Only Regulate Florida has enough signatures to even get the Supreme Court review. Last week, Make It Legal Florida, which is headed up by MedMen, one of the MMTC's lobbyists, they registered language that's going to it proposes to legalize adult use for those over 21, and it allows, the key here is that it allows the existing MMTCs to continue to sell medical and will have the extended ability to sell adult use. A lot of people are upset about that because it wouldn't open up the market, but as we just discussed with the first DCA opinion, those MMTCs, it may be expanded. They may allow for more licenses. So Make It Legal Florida's language may not be as restrictive as people think, depending on what the definition of MMTC ends up being. And then there's a third one, Floridians for Freedom, which simply just deregulates recreational marijuana.
Our cannabis contributors, Sally and Shelton, making their regular appearance on the show this morning. Sally Peebles, attorney and columnist Shelton Hall. What are your thoughts about the way medical marijuana is distributed in Florida? Where do you stand on whether to legalize it all the way, as some other states have done? The number to join us is 549-2937. Okay, as we're seeing public opinion move so dramatically on this, Shelton, let me ask you as a follow-up. Florida is now one of 16 states where officials are investigating lung-related illnesses that have suspected ties to vaping, e-cigarette use, primarily nicotine, but vaping is also a way for some people to ingest cannabis. What about the argument that increasing access to this drug could result in lung-related illnesses?
Well, you know, Florida in general is kind of hazardous to your lungs. There's a lot of ways you can you can go swimming at the beach. You can go walking through downtown in certain parts.
Lots of hazards, yes. But in all seriousness.
Well, with this, it's an evolving technology, and we've heard different complications related to e-cigs and vape pens. As you said, mostly with the e-cigs. Those seem to be a little more problematic. We've had issues of these things blowing up in people's pockets, things like that. Most people will tell you that when you go to, say, to hit a vape pen, it's not as strong as one might initially suspect. People are used to smoking cigarettes or joints, so they'll go to inhale, and they're not taking in that, like, visceral puff of smoke. So their first thought is to, you know, pull on it even harder, and then it goes right into your lungs, and that causes coughing and whatnot. It's a very strong thing. The advantage of the vape pens is that it is so concentrated, and you can do very small doses, take a small little puff. It doesn't leave a lot of odor, you know, whatnot. But the downside is if you're a frequent recreational smoker, that particular delivery method might cause you some problems down the road.
Sally, what about this? According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, 66% of teens are, when they vape, they're just using flavored e-cigs. Some are using nicotine, about 13%. About 6% say they're vaping marijuana.
So I'm not a doctor. I'm a regulatory attorney. I haven't seen a lot of the research tied to cannabis. Usually I see it tied to nicotine and e-cigarettes. But really, I see this as an even strong indicator of why we need to regulate, because if we're the regulation of cannabis, if we have a product on the shelves that is causing an issue, if it's regulated, the authorities can identify the source. They can pull that product from the shelves and reach out to the people who may have used it and tell them of the dangers. When it's not regulated, you're not really aware or not being able to get the research on, around the negative effects.
Okay, that brings us to a sea change in terms of how Florida is regulating another cannabis-related product, hemp. Can you bring us up to date on what's changed in terms of regulating the hemp crop here in the Sunshine State?
So earlier in the spring, the Floridian the legislature passed the Hemp Farming Act, which will allow licenses to be granted to those individuals seeking to cultivate hemp. It also legalized hemp extract. So the street word for that would be CBD. And it did legalize the sale and distribution of CBD. So that is legal today. It also set up a lot of labeling and packaging requirements and testing requirements. What's going on right now is that the Department of Agriculture is developing rules to implement that act. Those rules came out in a proposed form already, and we're waiting for those final rules to drop. A lot of people are kind of concerned about, you know, why it hasn't come out yet, but I think what they're really doing is waiting for the USDA to issue their final rules before for issuing Florida's rules, because if the USDA issues their rules, and we might have to go back and kind of change our Florida rules if they're not in line with those. So,
okay, rapidly moving landscape, so we always appreciate your legal insights, Sally. Also, a quick plug for Shelton Hall, regular column in Folio on cannabis. And thank you, Shelton, for your column in today's Folio on the 10th anniversary of this program. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome. You know, most of the columns are written by algorithms, but with this one, I wanted to actually go hands-on and use real
words. Old-fashioned way.
Yes.
Shelton Hull, Sally Kent Peoples, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And up next, growing permaculture here in Jacksonville. That's our Going Green. Back in a moment.
Hey, Melissa. David Luckin here. Boy, it's been 10 years since I called you out of the blue.
Don't say anything on the phone. Meet me right away. I'll wait for you in my car.
Well, we met at Three Layers. We had a great conversation. And guess who got hired 10 years ago? Then it was time for that first show, and you got us all ready by saying,
quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Theme song came up. All the lights. Oh, no. I'm sorry. Wrong theme. Now, here we go. This is the song we started with. And here we are 10 years later. Well, I wish you all the best. Let's do another 10 years together. And above all, and most importantly, stay human.
Cause the streets are alive with the sound of boom, pop. Can I hear it once again? Boom, pop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming.
because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every box got a right to be booming. Stay human.
To understand the human brain,
how can patterns of electrical pulses passing between cells be thought?
To figure out what makes us human,
why, when all that happens in this circuit, does it feel like something?
Might require unconventional methods.
Am I really gonna throw a human brain into a blender?
I'm Guy Raz, the unknown brain. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at 11 a.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, it's called permaculture, an emerging field using science to transform any property into an environmentally positive space. So how does permaculture work? We're curious to know, too. Josh Rosenberg is the owner of Native Jacks, Permaculture Designs, and Real Estate. He's here with more in our Going Green. Hey, Josh, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Okay, permaculture. Can you define that for us? What is it?
So permaculture, I think the easiest way to understand it is it's a design science that focuses on sustainable landscapes, using nature as a template to regenerate land into its highest and best use for what the client is looking for.
What would be an example of that? It sounds really cool, but I think if people listening might be a little confused. Mm-hmm. Paint a picture for us. What does this look like?
Sure. So permaculture really can be best used by taking property. It could be a vacant land or an urban lot and really turn it into something that's sustainable in terms of really producing food for people or creating a water catchment system so water isn't being wasted and running off mm-hmm. into things like that.
Now, one way that you work with people to install permaculture is to have them get rid of their lawn.
Yes.
Which is interesting because, of course, in America, people have this love of lawns, even mm-hmm. though they're environmentally disastrous.
Mm-hmm.
So if you convince someone to get rid of their lawn, mm-hmm. what goes in its place?
It depends what they're looking for. I can do a food forest in place of a lawn. We can do a garden. We can do a pollinator garden or just a native plant yard, really. It just depends on what the person's looking for. But there are many different opportunities to get rid of your grass and put something in there that's really positive for the environment.
And you're even working now with the Duval Soil and Water Conservation District.
Yes.
This is a government entity that doesn't get a lot of attention, but what they mm-hmm. do is actually pretty important.
Yes.
What are you doing with soil and water?
Yeah, I was really excited to become an affiliate member with them, and I'm working with them on taking certain little pieces of property and transforming them. We want to do a demonstration site, so we're working with a couple other city groups to try and really find a good piece of property to turn into a food forest, park type of place, especially downtown in a food desert. We're trying to make that happen and really get soil and water, you know, conservation really a number one priority here.
And you feel like it isn't right now?
It could be better.
It could be better.
Yes.
What are some examples of cities and places around the country where you see permaculture mm-hmm. more in the mainstream and it's being yeah. used more frequently?
Right. So Atlanta, I haven't been to anything, but I hear a lot of news in Atlanta of them doing a food forest and permaculture type of things. But I'm up in Asheville, North Carolina a lot, and they are really pushing permaculture up there. There's a big permaculture scene, and I'm involved with a lot of things over there that they're doing too.
Okay. And Asheville, of course, is seen by many as this cutting edge place. Jacksonville, unfortunately, is not always first with these kinds of trends.
Right.
How challenging is it to kind of get the ball rolling on something like this in a city like Jacksonville?
I've had a lot of really good responses. I've held classes and kind of just spread the word through some Facebook groups and things like that. And it seems like a lot of people are really interested in transforming their properties into something that is more sustainable.
How do you advise people, and this question comes up a lot, Joshua, mm-hmm.
They want to do a garden or native plants. They want to get rid of the lawn, and their homeowners association gives mm-hmm. them a hard time.
Right. Yeah, that's a tough one, the homeowners associations. But I have worked with people before that are with the homeowners associations, and basically we just have to follow their kind of guidelines, work around it, work with them, maybe even help change their guidelines. But that is, yeah, a little bit more of a challenge, but
because
it's possible.
Legally, you are within your rights. Is my understanding, you can right. challenge your HOA on this
right.
because increasingly homeowners are trying to do that.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And I think everybody should. You know, I think that some of the regulations that the HOAs have are really detrimental to our environment.
Because whether it's lawns or anything that requires fertilizer and a lot of water
right.
is bad. It's not what we want.
Exactly.
That's generally what you're arguing, Josh, is less of that.
Right.
Low maintenance, native plants that don't need a lot of chemicals. Can rely on the sun and the rain.
Right. That's don't need any chemicals at all.
Yeah,
really.
That's where you're going.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's possible. And there's places all over the world that are proving this beyond, you know, just a theory. I mean, there are a lot of really cool projects out there.
How do you see the Emerald Trail, which mm-hmm. Groundwork Jacksonville is raising a lot of money to construct, this greenbelt around the city, which is really beautiful when you look at the renderings of it. Is that, in your view, permaculture?
Well, it seems like they're kind of just creating this pathway. They are doing some cool stuff by adding trees and stuff like that. But I would really love to see little nooks, little park nooks that have a food forest in there. And food forests sound kind of, you know, like a forest. It sounds really kind of just enclosed, but really you can make it into a park and make it beautiful and have fruit trees and little vegetable gardens that people can tend around that necklace. It would be really cool, I think.
That would be a cool addition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with all of that said, if people are intrigued by this and they want to bring you out to their home or business,
mm-hmm.
how does that work?
Sure. Well, they can reach out to me on nativejacks.com and they can call me or email me or whatever. But basically, I'll do a consultation. Free consultation, give them an idea of what's possible. Then we can work on putting together a design and installation and even a maintenance type of package.
Because don't people switch to this because they want less maintenance?
They
Isn't
want
that
less
the
maintenance.
Idea? That's what I would want.
Yes. Yeah, and there is, you know, in the beginning, you will have to do more work and more maintenance. But over time, it switches where you're doing less work and less maintenance and having a higher yield. Of whatever you're growing out
yeah.
there.
Flowers, produce, you name it.
Right.
Joshua Rosenberg, he is the owner at Native Jacks. It's Native Jacks Permaculture Designs. You can learn more at nativejacks.com. Really interesting. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, a quick break. And in a moment, as we celebrate 10 years of First Coast Connect this week, we're taking a look at how business has grown in Northeast Florida over the last decade. The business maven of this city, Karen Bruni Mathis, knows more than just about anybody all about that, and we will speak to her right after this. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Dan Scanlon from the Times Union. Only in Florida could Melissa Ross take a great career in television news and then transfer it to 10 years of learned, educated talk show expertise on WJCT. Congratulations for a great decade.
Listen to Pop-Up Country on 89.9 HD4 and explore country, folk, bluegrass, and blues by the musicians who created it as we get ready for Ken Burns' latest documentary, Country Music, coming to WJCT-TV in September.
Join WJCT for a private member reception and screening of the new Downton Abbey movie on Thursday, September 19th at the Cinemark Tinseltown. 6 p.m. reception and 7 p.m. screening. $50 donation. Costumes are encouraged. For more information, go to wjct.org/events.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Supporters of Medicare for All say complicated paperwork and billing procedures drive up the cost of private insurance plans. But would a single-payer system be any cheaper?
We can save approximately $500 billion a year just in administration costs.
We'll take a closer look at the numbers next time on Here and There.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Sixty-four years after Emmett Till was murdered, telling the story of his lynching remains fraught in Mississippi.
The issue of race is still the undercurrent about the discussion of Emmett Till.
Monuments in the state to remember Till are repeatedly attacked by vandals. The ongoing fight to memorialize Till's story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
President Trump is betting the farm on a new trade deal with China. But what do farmers think about that? U.S. exports of farm products to China have fallen sharply, and businesses are hurting. Free trade and farmer fatigue. The view from Minnesota, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
First Coast Success is brought to you by Iberia Bank.
Welcome back. Well, all this week we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of First Coast Connect with a look at some of the changes around town over the last decade. That includes robust business growth over the last 10 years. Can we sustain it? I learned more from Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jax Daily Record.
I can't think of a better person than you to look at the sweep of business growth on the First Coast over the last 10 years. As a editor of the Jacksonville Daily Record and a former reporter and columnist looking at business for the Times Union, you've been covering this a long time. You've seen a lot of changes, right?
I've seen a ton of changes. And when people say what's changed, I'm thinking, well, am I looking over the past week, the past month, the past year, the past decade? Because it is speeding up. The city and the area have changed more probably in the past 10 years than they have before that. And I think one of the biggest things that we're seeing is more of the regionalism. We are seeing a ton of growth going down into St. Johns County. We're seeing growth in Clay County and, of course, in Nassau County. And that really is bringing the region into what we call Jacksonville.
It's not Duval County proper. It's becoming more of a mega region like Orlando or South Florida.
It really is, and especially when you look at northern St. Johns County, because you have so much residential growth down there, and now you have a lot of the retail growth. But Jacksonville also, as you know, St. Johns Town Center pretty much put that part of the city on the map, and what that spawned at St. Johns Town Center, it has gone far beyond just the 200 acres that the town center proper is on. You look all around it, and you've got the Top Golf, you've got iFly, north, south, east, west, and that's continuing.
Would you call that the biggest business story of the last decade in this city, the massive growth in and around the St. Johns Town Center?
You know, I can't think of anything that would really be much larger when it comes to a region of or an area of growth within Duval County. You take a look at downtown, it's continuing to try. There are a lot of efforts being made downtown, but I know that all the predictions that, you know, you heard the landing was going to trigger downtown growth, you heard the convention center, and I've heard this for decades. And it's like there needs to be something that triggers all that growth. And there is growth downtown. If you look at the Barnett, and you look at some of the other projects that are downtown, you're seeing some big changes.
Revitalizing some old buildings, particularly along Laura Street.
Yes, Laura Street in particular. But you look around downtown, look what's happened in Brooklyn. Look at Riverside. Look at what is happening in Springfield. And a prediction I'm going to go ahead and make right now, but we hear about Lot J and all of that. Well, that's just a bridge away from Arlington, Old Arlington, and I think you're going to see big growth in Old Arlington right across the bridge.
And why do you think that?
Because Alex Sifakis has purchased the Town and Country Shopping Center, and there's a lot of other opportunity in that area to revitalize. That area is, you know, 50, 60 years old, and it was kind of overlooked. People just drive by it, and it's right there. It's right on the other side of the bridge from downtown, and I think that you can revitalize housing and retail, and you can bring in a lot. And Wawa's going in there. And
that's a bellwether, isn't it?
Well, it is. When you look at Wawa goes in sometimes and buys old properties and clears the site and builds anew. And they're not taking historic properties. They're taking just properties that it's probably time to have a better use for the site.
Interesting. So we've talked about the really big business headlines over the last decade. What is something that's been under the radar that people might not be as aware of, but that you know about?
I would say that what everyone should look for is infill development. Arlington is infill development. Downtown is infill development. But I think almost anywhere you go in Jacksonville, barring a recession, you're going to continue to see a lot of infill development. You go down to Bay Meadows, and you see the old Bay Meadows golf course, and that's going to become housing and retail. And there are sites like that, large and small, all over the city. There also continues to be a lot of property out there for the large developments. They used to be called developments of regional impact, but large planned unit developments. And you're seeing that being played out in far west Jacksonville with the trails, which of course is being opposed by a lot of the residents out there. And you're going to see more of this in North Jacksonville, and you're going to see even more in Northwest Jacksonville. All of these areas, again, I have to say, barring a recession, are really on track for that. And you're also seeing a lot of industrial development, a lot of warehouses, a lot of distribution centers have come into Jacksonville. I think there are 12 or 13 active centers now that haven't been completely leased.
Let's hope we don't have a recession.
I know I keep saying that, and people are like, sure. What do you know? But when you look at how long the recovery has been, it's been a long time. And there's a lot of talk in the Wall Street Journal writes about it. It's out there. How long is this going to last? Nobody knows how long the recovery is going to last. But it's out there, and you think about it, and you have to plan for it.
Something to watch for. Your insights are so valuable to this program and to our station in general, so we can't thank you enough for recapping the last decade in business with us, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jax Daily Record. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz, the one who makes the magic. Michelle Corum is the queen of all she surveys, our serene and majestic director. Tomorrow, a look at the effects of toxic stress on local children. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for music. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.